Statewide satellite distribution of this program is made possible by the Lawrence Group, providing residents throughout New York State with total insurance coverage.
This program is a production of WAMC News. From Albany, this is the Legislative Gazette, a weekly half-hour review of New York State government and politics. Your host is political scientist and syndicated columnist Dr. Alan Chartock of the State University.
Hello and welcome to the Legislative Gazette. This week we'll look at the Semitech and Super Collider projects. What's happening to these proposals and more. We'll talk about the investigation into the director of the state Thruway Authority, Alexander Levine. And we'll take a look at why Governor Cuomo is campaigning across the country but not running for president. A new statewide bill may put restrictions on vicious dogs. We'll hear about that and much, much more. It's all coming up on this week's Legislative Gazette. Lieutenant Governor Stan Lundeen has run into some problems with his pet project, the Super Collider. Bruce Robertson has this report.
New York now has only two proposed sites for the federal Super Collider research project. The third site, in the lower Hudson Valley, was withdrawn from consideration after residents of the area turned out to oppose it. But that was not the reason cited by the state when Lieutenant Governor Stanley Lundeen made the announcement Thursday morning at the state capitol.
We're withdrawing the Hudson Valley proposal because there's a region-wide consensus that the area cannot accommodate the economic growth that would accompany the Super Collider. We have always recognized that the Hudson Valley is an area of the state experiencing strong economic growth. Along with low unemployment, the area is also striving to deal with some problems of overdevelopment. Nevertheless, from the time we first proposed the project and submitted our proposals to the federal government, we've been told by elected representatives and others in the Hudson Valley that the net effect of the Super Collider on the region would be positive. Yet, in the last month, many of these same individuals who had previously supported the project in the spring and summer have reversed their assessment. After consulting with a broad range of business, governmental, and other leaders in the Hudson Valley, it's clear to me that this area of the state is not willing, nor is it able to accommodate the changes and the economic development that the project would bring. Because of this carefully considered assessment, and not because of protests or threats, we're convinced that the Hudson Valley proposal no longer has a reasonable chance of being selected as the site for this federal project.
Lieutenant Governor Stanley Lundeen speaking Thursday morning at the state capitol. He went on to say that all factors at a proposed site must be considered in order for the location to be viewed as ideal. He said he understands how the citizens of the Mid-Hudson area are concerned about rapid overdevelopment of the area from the more congested urban areas to the south. He says of the other two sites, Williamson, east of Rochester, is considered the best because the business community is quite eager there. Even though the town board of Williamson has voted unanimously to send a message to the Urban Development Corporation not to bring the Super Collider to Williamson. A footnote. One of the sites from the 25 states competing for the location will be selected by the federal government in January. And in the end, New York may not even be chosen. Reporting for the Legislative Gazette, this is Bruce Robertson in Albany.
New York officials have been busy wooing representatives on a billion-dollar research facility that might be located in the capital region. Maury Small has this report.
New York mounted an impressive reception on Wednesday to try to attract Semitech. It's a planned $1.5 billion research facility now looking for a home. The Rensselaer Technology Park in North Greenbush is apparently in the final running for the project by a consortium of semiconductor companies. It'll be the first federally funded facility to research computer chips as the U.S. government tries to better compete with Japan on the world market. Semitech, which stands for semiconductor manufacturing technology will inject $250 million into the local economy and bring in about 800 employees. So it has sparked intense competition among New York, Massachusetts, Texas, Wisconsin, Arizona, and North Carolina, where sites are under consideration. When the Semitech team visited the Capital Region this week, they heard personal pitches from Governor Cuomo and Economic Development Director Vincent Tese touting the benefits of locating in the Capital Region. The various potential home states for Semitech are offering economic incentives to try to attract it. Harold Holzer, an aide to Tese, says New York's package is worth $100 million.
A $40 million interest-free loan on the basis of 30 years of no interest payments is a savings of $80 million. So we're calling that an $80 million package right there. Plus, we're talking about money for training, $12 million in power savings, forgiveness of sales taxes on construction, $100 million altogether, which we think makes us among the most generous proposals in the state. And the message the governor and Vincent Tese left the Semitech committee with was the following. Once you've looked around the country, if you have a proposal that you think is more generous than ours, give us the chance to match them, because we want New York. We want Semitech in New York.
Massachusetts officials say they're offering Semitech an economic incentive package worth $260 million. But Holzer says that total sounds like more than it is.
From our interpretation of, for early interpretation of their incentive package, it's a very soft package, and they compute their money in a way that, you know, sort of on the barter system and the value of services that are not really cash services. We think we're in there and very competitive right now.
In addition to financial lures, the Semitech Consortium is looking for extensive cooperation from universities wherever it locates. The Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy heads a group of universities pledging to work with Semitech if it lands in the Capital Region. The Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Yale, Cornell, Columbia, and SUNY also back the Capital Region offer. Congress is expected to vote soon on the federal appropriation that will provide half the funding for Semitech. For the Legislative Gazette, this is Maury Small.
Recently, State Inspector General Joseph Spinelli, after looking into the affair of Alexander Levine, recommended to the governor that his four-month investigation be turned over to a prosecutor. Brenda McMahon has more.
The investigation will be handed over to the Albany County District Attorney Saul Greenberg, State Attorney General Robert Abrams, and the State Investigation Commission. Greenberg, the Albany District Attorney, says when he receives Spinelli's report, he'll use it as the basis for his own investigation.
Well, we will look at the Inspector General's report, take a look at it first, and make a determination as to whether or not his findings are such as to indicate there might be some criminality, or at least to the point where we should present to a grand jury. It's my further understanding that a copy of the same report will be sent to the Attorney General also. So they do have some criminal prosecution jurisdiction. Once we've had an opportunity to read it and go over it, we'll probably compare notes with the Attorney General's office and make determination as to who's going to handle what.
Greenberg also praises Inspector Spinelli, saying he has great respect for his investigative abilities.
I have complete confidence in his integrity. I've worked with him in the past. He's a professional with high integrity, and consequently, we will look at it and then make determination as to whether we will or won't do anything.
Levine has been accused of setting up a computer software firm called Betasoft. He allegedly steered engineering companies wanting to do business with the Thruway Authority to do business with the software firm. Betasoft was dissolved earlier this year. Levine's daughter was one of the firm's owners, and another Thruway Authority employee was reported to have been a Betasoft stockholder. Cynthia Bloom resigned from her job in July. The initial investigation began from an anonymous letter which accused Levine of conflict of interest. Levine is still the director of the State Thruway Authority, but he has filed his retirement papers, and he's planning to leave his $83,000 a year post by the end of October. For the Legislative Gazette, this is Brenda McMahon.
Thank you. As I do most every week, I recently spoke with Fred Dicker, Capitol Bureau Chief for the New York Post. We talked about the State of the Assembly and the new Speaker Mel Miller, about Governor Cuomo's apparent non-political trips throughout the country, and what's happening with another investigation right here in Albany.
Fred, it seems to me that Mario Cuomo has been behaving in a very strange way. As you know, I have tremendous admiration for him. At the same time he's yelling he will not be a candidate for president of the United States, he is really burning rubber, as we say, going around giving speeches all over the country. Now it's announced he's actually going to be playing a role with Governor Thompson on the other side in the primary, in the essential primaries, questioning candidates of the other party. What is going on here? Is it that he's just driving people crazy and teasing them, or is there something more to it?
Alan, I think he's having a great deal of fun, and I think he frankly is surprised that he is where he is. After all, he's only been governor for 4 3/4 years, and he's a national figure, an international figure. He's touted as a guy who could have the Democratic nomination for the asking. What has he done to achieve all that except give a few speeches, which were of great eloquence but didn't contain any major new ideas as far as I could tell? I think the answer is... He really hasn't done anything and finds himself in this position. He's startled by it. He's heard the critics over the months say he doesn't know this country, he doesn't know foreign affairs. So we've seen him go to Russia last month. We hear now he's going to Mexico. He's traveling this country more and more, being treated as a celebrity. And look, as we both know, politicians don't get into the business that they're in because they have no need for ego gratification. It's very heady when you travel the country and you get greeted wherever you go with front page stories as possible nominee for president. I think he's enjoying himself. I think he's having a good time. I think he feels he can make some contributions to the national debate. But I don't think he will ruin all this, ruin his good times, ruin the attention he's getting by announcing for president and then being subjected to the kind of scrutiny that we all know candidates have to undergo and we all know the governor does not enjoy.
Now, but that's a sort of, he lucked into this.
What else do you think it is?
Well,
you're a student of this guy, Alan.
Yes, I am.
What has he done to justify the attention he's getting?
What has
he done here in New York? Can you think of a couple of important initiatives here?
I know guys who say to me that every night Mario Cuomo goes to sleep, turns to Matilda and says, "Matilda, it's working. I can't believe it's working." In other words, you're ascribing this to almost happenstance. There are plenty of people who think he knows exactly what he's doing.
I think they're wrong. Alan, I mean, what has the governor done in this state to make the problem of the homeless in New York City any better? What has he done to reduce crime in the subway system? What has he done upstate to address the problem, say, of relative poverty in the Adirondacks? I argue nothing.
Well, look, there are a lot of people who argue the opposite.
Well, give me an example of what
he's given.
You know, just tell our listeners out there.
Come on, Freddie, that he's put twice as many people in prison as were there.
Well, we know he didn't do that.
Well, but they are there. And
no, that's the stuff of a campaign, but it's not the stuff that convinces the masses of people.
Well, okay, you know, Fred, you can say what you want. The point is, I'm not going to argue that with you right now simply because... What I want to pay attention
Alan,
to...
I'm telling you, there's a national phenomenon underfoot here. Yeah. The Democratic Party is disintegrating. They're desperate. The friends in the media of the Democratic Party are looking for a savior to bail them out against the Republicans next year, and the governor is the anointed one.
Well, that may be so, but I'm still saying to you that there are plenty of people who are willing to credit a philosophy or a theoretical approach to Mario Cuomo. You're saying it's not so.
Correct. And I don't think there's any theoretical or philosophical approach. It's happenstance, and he has found himself in a spot that I guarantee you a couple of years ago he never would have imagined would happen. And nobody else would have imagined it either.
Okay. Switching from that subject to the next interesting one, his longtime close aide, Alexander Levine, now finds himself in a heap of trouble. Tell us about it.
Alan, with the most recent development in the Alexander Levine Thruway Authority affair is this. Somebody really boxed the governor badly by leaking to the New York Times a couple of days ago a story that Joseph Spinelli, Cuomo's inspector general for the state, had concluded in a report that Levine's alleged questionable activities concerning a company that his daughter had a business interest in and which was doing business with the Thruway Authority that he heads, in fact, that report should be given to criminal prosecutors for possible prosecution, meaning, of course, that Spinelli feels a crime may have occurred. The report, the leak, went on to say, however, that the governor's people were blocking the reports being given over to the prosecutors, i.e., a cover-up might be underway. Now, I wish I had had that story. Of course, I didn't, but I can tell you this. The fact that it hit the press meant that the Cuomo people were finished. They had to then hand the report over to the prosecutors, because to do anything else would have made it seem as if what was contained in the Times report, which was based on an anonymous source or sources, was correct, that a cover-up was underway. They handed over the report. The governor did a dramatic flip-flop at the same time, reversing the position he's held for months that the Inspector General's reports could not be made public, and said from now on they all will be made public.
Except, Fred, that you put the governor in a damned if he does, damned if he doesn't situation. In other words, he did do the right thing as opposed to the wrong thing, and you say, well, he was forced to do that, but how do we know that?
Well, that's just my estimate. I mean, the governor, I think, deserves a lot of criticism on this whole thing. I mean, he was telling us over and over again that we were fools. He was sneering at us for months when we suggested that the reports of the Inspector General, to be significant, to have an impact, to deter improper behavior, should be made public. I mean, I asked him and others asked him.
Wait a second now, Freddie. It's damned if he does, damned if he doesn't. On the one hand, you're telling us he handed over that report, which he was supposed to prosecutors, but you're saying that he was forced to do it.
Alan, you know, sometimes I think it's important for us in the media to keep in mind what's gone on in the past, to have some memory. We've been victimized by the governor for months. Every time I and others would suggest to him that the reports of his inspector general should be made public, he, in almost a humiliating fashion, said we were stupid, he couldn't possibly allow those reports to be made public. It would have a chilling effect on the investigative ability of the inspector general. When we all knew, and you knew it, I'm sure, that many investigative bodies, including grand juries, the State Investigations Commission, district attorneys, make their reports public. So now that the governor finally has agreed to do what was obvious from the beginning he should do, I don't think we should just sort of, you know, praise him to the hilltops. Was he right to do this? Yes. Should he have done it 3 months ago and avoided some of the problems he has now? Yes, as well.
Okay, now let's go back to where we started from, and that's the Assembly and the legislature. You wrote some scathing columns saying that Mel Miller is in real trouble. What's that all about?
Alan, I think it's shocking how badly the new Speaker of the Assembly, Melvin Miller of Brooklyn, a one-time reformer, has been acting vis-a-vis this whole legislative scandal. We've seen a number of signs of not an attempt to deal and ameliorate the problems at the legislature from Mel Miller, but just the opposite. For the last 4 or 5 months, it's become tougher than it ever has been in the 10 years I've been around the legislature to obtain payroll information, expenditure information from the Assembly. The press operation that Mel Miller put into effect seems more inclined to blockade us, to stonewall us, than to help us. And in fact, I've been asking for a week, how many people work for the Assembly House Operations Committee? That's the committee which is a holding tank for all these political operatives, and they still won't tell me. They haven't told me how many people work for a public commission. Last week, Mel Miller was asked, are there no-show employees at the legislature? Have you been aware of the use of campaigns of legislative employees? And he answered, as I think I may have indicated earlier, in a way that was sort of like a mafia leader's legalese to deny any knowledge of something instead of being up front and saying what went on and what's going on right now. There have been other examples. Just a few days ago, Alan, Lisa Bang Jensen, a reporter for the Inside Albany television show, went with a film crew to the offices of the Assembly House Operations Committee. Those offices in a private building are rented at taxpayer expense, maybe $300,000 a year. Not only was Bang Jensen denied access to the head of the committee and to the office suites of the committee, which he wanted to see, but she was thrown out of the office waiting room, being told that she had to wait out in the hallway by the elevator. Now, this is a public building, Alan. I can't understand how Melvin Miller, who did approve of that treatment of Bang Jensen, could allow it to occur and could offer himself as an important leader in this state while tolerating those kinds of practices.
You've been mentioning in your column that Norman Adler is sort of seen as a Svengali influence in this. Could you talk about that?
Well, maybe Rasputin. This is a very interesting character, a hardball player, been around the political scene a long, long time. Norman Adler of Brooklyn, former labor activist and labor hardball political operative, who Mel Miller picked to be his, really, his, I guess, his strategist, his number one non-elected aide, being paid a big salary. I think he makes about $70,000 a year. And many people believe he's been giving Miller bad advice, that his advice to Miller has been to stonewall the press on the scandal, to be confrontational when confronted, and to just apologize for the old ways. I mean, it seems incredible to many people, including me, that Mel Miller, Warren Anderson, I don't expect Fred Ornstein to get involved since he's under indictment, but that these leaders haven't stepped forward and said, look, we may have done things wrong in the past, but it's a new era, we recognize that, we're going to change. Not only has Mel Miller never said that, he seems to be an apologist for the old ways.
Fred Dicker of the New York Post. In another development in state government this week, Fred Dicker and several other reporters raided the Assembly House Operations offices in Albany, only to find that the Assembly Majority Party has their own sauna. Dave Gillette has this report.
Dicker has established a policy that to avoid disruption of the ongoing operations of the departments of the Assembly, reporters, photographers, and other media personnel will not be permitted spontaneous access to the Assembly's operations offices. Since the public has a right to know how their tax dollars are spent, media personnel will be admitted if they had made prior arrangements with the Assembly Press Office. In this manner, the Speaker hopes to strike a balance between the efficient operation of the legislature and the rights of the press.
That's Norman Adler, top aide to Assembly Speaker Mel Miller. He was reading a statement to reporters Thursday morning at the offices of the State Assembly's House Operations Staff in a downtown Albany office building. That statement was a prelude to some dramatic developments just minutes later, as New York Post reporter Fred Dicker and other reporters made another attempt to penetrate the mystery of the Assembly House Operations Committee. The reporters asked to speak with Richard Farfalia, director of House Operations. After about a 10-minute wait, Miller aide Adler came out to read the statement you just heard. Our microphones captured what happened next. Listen carefully.
Could we make an appointment now?
Talk to Jeff. Will, under this policy, will Mr. Farfalia be available to us?
Talk to Jeff.
But you can't tell us now? Only Jeff can tell us?
Jeff Taylor is handling that. I'm not the press officer, and you should call him and make arrangements. We'll be happy to accommodate you.
If Jeff is handling this, why were you sent out to deliver the message?
I happened to be in here, and Jeff was across the street. We wanted to have you not sit around and cool your heels for more moments than you had to, so that's why we did it this way.
Okay. And you're speaking for Assembly
I'm
Speaker Miller.
For the Miller.
Yes.
Yep.
We were led to understand that we would be able to see Mr. Farfalia, that he is in his office. Why, if he's down the hall, won't he allow us?
Who led you?
Receptionist. She said he is in his office.
He is in his office. He's also working. I'm here. We're in the middle of a meeting. Right. I came out because I was here, and we're not going to disrupt the meeting for you. But we'd be very happy to give you access. Just make an arrangement with Jeff Taylor.
Sir, do any of the employees here work in campaigns during campaign season?
Talk to Jeff.
Can't you tell us that?
Yeah.
Sir, also, we want to know, is there a sauna down the hall here? Is there a sauna that's used? Can we see if there is or not?
At this point, Dicker follows Adler down the hallway.
I'm afraid of you.
Excuse me, you can't go down
here.
I'm
not allowed in here, please. Excuse me.
No, it's not. Not the internet. Come on. You know what?
Who's paying for these space?
Seriously.
I mean, I'm asking you.
Get out of here. And make arrangements with Jeff, and get arrangements with Jeff Taylor.
Hey,
make arrangements with Jeff Taylor.
So,
with Jeff Taylor.
With Jeff Taylor. Jeff Taylor.
Right? Dicker is knocked to the floor here.
Jeff Taylor.
Make arrangements with Jeff Taylor. That's
why
the guard.
Why can't you,
with Jeff Taylor. You want to protect your privates? With Jeff Taylor. Get out of here and make arrangements with Jeff.
Get off my jacket.
Get arrangements
and move back.
Mr. Adler, why are you physically assaulting Mr. Dicker?
Make arrangements with Jeff Taylor. You're not allowed in here. You were told that. Get out.
Following the incident, Dicker said he was considering criminal assault charges against Adler. Jeff Taylor, the person referred to, is an Assembly press officer. In Albany, I'm Dave Gillette.
New York state lawmakers are on the attack against dangerous dogs. And it's not just the infamous pit bull. Brenda McMahon has this report.
That was the topic of a recent hearing in Albany, but lawmakers have decided not to isolate the problem to pit bulls. Assemblyman Richard Coombe, chairman of the Assembly Republican Panel on Vicious Dog Control, says all dogs could be dangerous, and so the legislation will define dangerous and potentially dangerous dogs rather than regulating one breed. The original drafted legislation requires dangerous dogs to be enclosed in a 6-foot-high, chained and locked fence and to have a muzzle device on when away from the premises. The owner is also required to have $100,000 in liability insurance and to register the pet. But Coombe says many recommendations were made at the hearing, and the bill may be amended.
Some of the additional information was that an emphasis on the fact that it should be statewide legislation that preempted local legislation, and along with that, that it should certainly be dangerous dog legislation rather than breed-specific, because the breed-specific legislation is one challenge being defeated in the courts across the nation. Also, there were areas where they felt that we should have some additional changes, for example, in our definitions, some changes there, and along with that, the confinement issue, that should be enlarged upon so that dog owners would be aware of the fact that confinement as well as destruction of the dogs would be options for them.
One participant, Assemblyman Arnold Proskin, says although he has had no complaints of dangerous dogs in his district, he's aware that this is a statewide problem. But one of Proskin's concerns is the protection of individuals' property rights.
My concern, of course, is property rights of individuals. There's a balancing effect that has to be brought into play. When a person owns a dog, he has certain rights because of this right of ownership. Of course, these rights have to be balanced against the right of the public to be protected against some animal, perhaps, that can hurt individuals. So that's my concern, of course, is not to jeopardize individuals' rights any more than they actually have to be.
Assemblyman Proskin hasn't made a decision about supporting the drafted legislation, but Coombe says he has a lot of support in both the Senate and the Assembly. So much support that he believes the bill will pass the Assembly during the 1988 legislative session.
Well, you might be surprised at this, but I do believe dangerous dog legislation will be passed in the 1988 legislative session. The reason is the public is clamoring for change. Certainly, it's been in the media to a great extent, especially the pit bulldog issue. And I think the best way to protect the safety of the public and at the same time to provide some protection for the dog owners and so forth would be to go the dangerous dog legislative route and have it statewide. It's my feeling members in both houses and in both political parties agree with that type concept, and so now it'll be getting on to get the job done, getting meaningful legislation passed in the next session.
The current bill defines a dangerous dog as one that attacks a person without provocation, and a potentially dangerous dog as one that, when unprovoked, chases or approaches a person in a menacing fashion or apparent attitude of attack. For the Legislative Gazette, this is Brenda McMahon.
And that's it for this week's Legislative Gazette. The show was produced by Brenda McMahon, and she had help this week from Maury Small, Bruce Robertson, and Lynn Matty Evans. We hope you enjoyed our show, and you'll tune in again next week for more on what's happening in and around the New York State Capitol. Until then, I'm Alan Chartock.
The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC News. Dr. Alan Chartock is executive producer. This program is made possible with funds provided by the State University College at New Paltz.
Statewide satellite distribution of this program was made possible by the Lawrence Group, providing residents throughout New York State with total insurance coverage.